KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Medical mistakes are now the number three cause of death in the United States, writes Dr. Marty McCary. McCary is a surgeon and the author of the book Unaccountable: What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15th, 2012.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming. And I see some friends here. I want to thank Jordan for being here, and Peter, who's a good friend. My friend Walter, who's Canadian, which is okay. As we were taught in the School of Public Health, the Canadian is essentially an unarmed American with health insurance. So it's okay. You know, I'm from Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., we notice all the politicians start by doing the right thing, the thing your mother always teaches you to do, to recognize those that are there and to thank those who invited you. And the first time I gave a speech at a national conference was about 10 years ago. It was my first year on the faculty at Johns Hopkins. I was very excited, and I walked into an auditorium that seats about 1,000 people, and I got up to the podium, and I looked out, and I noticed there were only two people in the audience, and I was talking about this very same subject, patient safety and overtreatment. It just goes to show the level of interest in that subject at the time. And I didn't know what to do, so I started off by just saying, I want to thank both of you for coming. And they looked at each other and said, we're just here because we're given the next two talks. So we've come a long way in healthcare talking about this subject. You know, if you talk to most hospital CEOs and ask them, what is your number one priority? A lot of them today will now say patient safety. The field has come a long distance. Now, when I talk to my students in the School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins and teach on health policy, when I start talking about healthcare representing 1/6 of the U.S. economy and 23 cents on every dollar going to Medicare expenditures on the interest on the debt, which Medicare accrues because the system's bankrupt, I look out in the audience and all I see is uvulas because they're asleep. They don't like the numbers. And I notice when I share some personal stories, they connect with it. And I do the same on TV. I go on some of these networks. Forgive me for going on Fox News. When I talk about these subjects, I've realized when we talk about the magnitude of the problem, it's kind of like one in four children in the world being hungry, or one of these statistics that is so big it doesn't resonate. So I feel the need to just share personal experiences. And let me just share a couple with you here that are kind of fun. You know, I learned a lot about the publishing industry. I've written things in healthcare for doctors, but never something for the general public. And this is kind of the first time I'm doing something like this. I normally am talking to medical audiences. And when I first talked to someone about the book in the publishing industry, they said, oh, yeah, this is going to be a great book. We're going to name it The 50 Shades of Healthcare. And I thought, no, we're not. This is going to be a book that's not going to alienate the medical profession. Instead, it's going to talk the same language to the general public that we should be talking to doctors with. And we've got 1 million doctors in the country. We cannot afford to alienate that group. That group is one of our key allies in fixing the problem. Now, what problem am I talking about? Well, medical mistakes. If you actually look at the research and compile the data using figures from the most respected journals in medicine and the most respected bodies in healthcare, like the Institute of Medicine and the New England Journal of Medicine, medical mistakes are now the number three cause of death in the United States. You see, we've got a healthcare system that's so complex, we haven't kept up with the coordination of services, and people get hurt. Now, some people have said that's not true, and I got one letter after this book. I've got about 1,000 emails and probably about 500 handwritten letters, some type letters, that say, you know, my mother was hurt from a medical mistake. I lost my son from a medical mistake. You know, everybody's got a story. It's amazing. Everybody's got a story of a family member or loved one. We just haven't talked about this problem, honestly, for a long time. And when I first went to medical school, I noticed that we were taught this term, still sticks in my mind, epistaxis. And I remember thinking, epistaxis, what is it? So I forgot what that means, and they explained it means a hemorrhage from the nasal region, and I thought, oh, wait, hemorrhage, you're bleeding from your nasal nose, it's a nosebleed. And they said, well, it's epistaxis. And I said, well, okay, but isn't that a nosebleed? We call it epistaxis. I said, well, let me ask, could an epistaxis be anything else except for a nosebleed? And they said, no. Could a nosebleed be anything else except for epistaxis? No. We call it epistaxis. And it was clear we're talking a totally different vocabulary from the general public. It's almost as if we're in a parallel universe. It's almost as if we're floating in a different orbit talking about the same thing. It's almost as if we've created a language to enable the public to have a perception that we're an arrogant profession. It didn't make any sense to me. And at the same time, I noticed the great art of medicine, the art which allows a doctor to put a knife to someone's skin within minutes of meeting them just because they're the doctor. The same wonderful art of medicine which will have somebody in the emergency room tell me secrets they won't even tell their spouse just because I'm the doctor. It's a tremendous and awesome profession. Yet I noticed this art that my father practiced in his field of hematology lose the trust of the public over the decades. It's almost as if the current perception of the field of medicine has eroded to a point now where some find medicine to be a closed-door culture, sometimes a culture that is not forthright. I noticed this a little bit in medical school, but I think every doctor does. It may bother them a little bit. When I got to my third year of medical school, I saw a group of surgeons want to do something to a patient that I was in charge of taking care of, and I talked to her about what they proposed doing. She had cancer that had spread. She didn't really want anything done. She didn't have much family, but she just wanted to get out of the hospital and sort of spend the last few months of her life at home recovering. Well, when I explained this to the team of surgeons at the conference, we have a daily rounds and a weekly conference, and we had both that morning, and I explained she didn't want anything done. They basically were frustrated with me. They wanted to do this procedure. They thought it was the thing she needed. They explained to her, in their way, you need to have this done. She didn't know what was going on. She's confused, scared, and she agreed to it. I'm convinced the doctors understated the risks and overstated the benefits. She had a terrible complication and spent the last 2 months of her life in the hospital recovering from this very painful complication. Well, that was the breaking point. I had had enough. I just couldn't bear to watch it. I felt as if medicine had strayed so far from its ideal mission, it wasn't telling the truth as it should in many cases. I didn't really want to have anything to do with it. So I left medical school and started this program in public health. There I met all these wonderful doctors that were both practicing medicine the way that I had always dreamt it should be practiced, and at the same time they were honest about the problem of medical mistakes. I noticed one doctor approach a patient and he said, you know, we meant to order a CAT scan on the patient next door. It was accidentally ordered in your chart and you had the scan done. I'm sorry, it's not how we do things around here. and we will let you know the results as soon as we find out about them. Then he went over to the other patient's room and said, I'm sorry, we didn't mean to not get the scan today. There was an accident, and we're going to get your scan done right away. I'm going to go down there and make sure you get it done. And I thought, oh my gosh, look at this level of honesty. And in both cases, the patient had this bond that just glued at that moment. And it was almost as if the patients were okay with the human side of making mistakes, but they were hungry for honesty. There was this thirst just to be honest with what's going on. And that really left a great impression on me. I really missed bedside care, and I got back into medical school. Mom was happy about that. And for a long time, I sort of stood back in the residency and went into general surgery residency, and I had heard about this sort of malignant culture, this so-called trench warfare, the battle mentality, the survival instinct, the house of God, all these things, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to turn off the idealism, but every now and then, my professor said, step back and take some notes. And the book is essentially a compilation of some of those notes. But it became clear to me that people are frustrated with the healthcare system outside, and also the doctors. 46% of doctors in the United States are burned out, according to the Mayo Clinic study that came out 3 months ago. Now, in any industry, when you've got 46% of your frontline workers burned out, of course you're going to have massive variations in quality. Of course you're going to have mistakes and things falling through the cracks. Of course you're going to have over-treatment and malalignment of incentives. You know, at one of the conferences I went to, one of the doctors asked the audience of about 2,000 doctors, how many of you know of another doctor who should not be practicing because they're too dangerous? Every single hand went up. And there's this frustration in healthcare. The doctors share it. And that's what we're seeing in this 46%. For the first time, we're seeing doctors leave medicine and take on other careers. We're seeing doctors tell their kids, don't go into this field. I mean, what's happening? Well, I'm convinced the wisdom is there. And in any industry, if you simply talk to the frontline workers, they'll tell you what's wrong with a company. And in healthcare, it's no different. If we talk to the nurses and doctors that work on the front line, they'll tell you why they don't like practicing medicine. They'll say, look, I don't like the pressure of seeing all these patients in 1 hour. I don't like the insurance hassles. I don't like the regulations. I don't like getting text messages or emails from my boss saying, do more operations by the end of the fiscal quarter in order to get your end-of-year bonus. All emails that doctors have shared with me because they know I'm interested in this subject. You know, it's not just in healthcare, but increasingly in society, frontline workers feel a growing divide with their managers. And has anyone heard of Richard Fuld? He's kind of the poster child, I think, a former CEO of Lehman Brothers. He had his limo driver call before he got to the office every morning and have the lobby cleared and the elevator held so he would go directly to his office. In the words of one of his own vice presidents, he went out of the way to make sure he never interacted with a single employee of that bank, except for his little executive team. By contrast, Steve Jobs made sure there was one cafeteria at Apple, and they had open tables. He would sit there and interact with everybody and ask them what they think and learn and listen. Two radically different management styles, which unfortunately, both of which have penetrated American healthcare. Morale is highly variable in U.S. hospitals. We've studied it. We've given hospitals questionnaires for their employees to fill out. And in almost half of U.S. hospitals, the employees there would not go there for their own health care. Now, if you had to choose a hospital, you don't want to go where nobody would go for their own care. In the words of one great economist, no one in the history of the world has ever washed a rental car. Have you ever heard anybody say, hey, you know this rental, let's just go wash it before we drop it off? I mean, nobody, you know, that's like somebody saying, you know, where do you want to go for dinner? Let's go to the hospital. They have great food. You never hear that, right? People don't wash a rental car because you don't own the rental car. And a lot of times the doctors and nurses are saying, you know, we don't feel that we own the delivery of care anymore. We know how to deliver better and safer medical care, but we just don't feel empowered. We don't feel that our input is solicited. And we've asked that question in this survey. Do you feel that your safety concerns are solicited and well received by your managers? In some hospitals, 99% of the employees say yes, and others only 10% say yes. This is a safety culture survey now that is available on the government's website. A branch of the Division of Health and Human Services tells every hospital to take this survey. And yet the results, even though the survey is in part taxpayer funded, is not available to the public. In fact, our research group looked at national registries that track hospital performance and found over 200 national registries. Only 3 make their data available to the public, even though most are taxpayer funded. Now, you can get a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, for anything in government. And that's how they went after the director of the CIA. Yet, information about hospital performance lives on an island that nobody can get to. Now, in the few databases that are publicly available, we learned a couple things recently. In September, the front page of the New York Times, 1 in 5 organs removed for transplantation are never used. They're wasted or thrown away. In New York, there was a C-section done on a woman who wasn't even pregnant. Forgive me for laughing, but you can almost see yourself making these mistakes sometimes when you realize the human, the way that these things can be done. You know, retain sponges, leaving sponges behind. We did a recent study that found that we had calculated 80,000 leftover sponges in the last 20 years in the United States. There, it's easy to make mistakes, and yet in the aviation industry, when a plane crashes, everybody learns from the crash. There's an investigation, a black box is retrieved, the information is used for a report, and every pilot in the country knows the lesson from that mistake. Yet in healthcare, the same mistakes happen over and over again.
Marty McCary, a surgeon and the author of Unaccountable: What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Marty McCary in a moment, 824 94.9, KUOW. After a deadly fire in a Bangladesh clothing factory, a document search reveals that big clothing retailers balked at paying for fire security measures to avoid the cost. Also, Donald Trump has banned Glenfiddich Scotch from his bars after his nemesis, lowly Scottish farmer Michael Forbes, is awarded top Scot. Also, a former worker returns to London, Ontario's decommissioned Caterpillar locomotive plant to watch his workplace of 25 years sold to the highest bidder. And a remembrance of renowned architect Oscar Niemeyer, who died yesterday at age 104. All these items tonight, beginning right after the 11 o'clock news. Forecast says lows near 40 tonight, breezy, showers likely. Friday highs in the 40s, breezy, showers likely.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. As a surgeon, Marty McCary is aware of the amazing powers of modern medicine. But he's also witnessed medical errors that can have tragic circumstances. Wrong limbs amputated. Children getting the wrong doses of medicine because of bad handwriting. Surgical sponges left inside patients. McCary is the author of Unaccountable: What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15th, 2012.
You know, the Institute of Medicine recently took a bold step, and they affirmed a number that many of us have suspected for a long time, many of us that practice medicine devote most of our lives to it. 30% of all of healthcare expenditures are unnecessary. 30% of all medications, procedures, tests, unnecessary. Now, these are not outside bodies that are saying you doctors are overdoing it. These are doctors speaking up about a problem that frustrates us as much as it frustrates the public. Let me give you some specifics. 20% of blood transfusions unnecessary, according to the journal Transfusion Medicine. These are doctors who specialize in blood transfusion who wrote about the problem to a medical audience in a respected medical peer-reviewed journal. Matter of fact, the marginal difference in the blood shortage is based on a difference of about 5 to 7%. And we're all told we need to donate blood because of a blood shortage crisis, yet 20% is overused. It may be, in fact, that we don't have a blood shortage crisis. We have a blood overuse crisis. 23% of defibrillators are placed without clinical indications, JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. 44% of back surgery referrals, unnecessary, Journal of Radiology. 15% of hysterectomies, one of the most common procedures in the United States, unnecessary, Archives of Surgery. 12% of stents, unnecessary, heart stents, JAMA. 47% of pap smears, Annals of Internal Medicine. 51% of follow-up scans. That's when you get a scan and they say, need another scan to clarify. 51% actually unnecessary, the Journal of Clinical Radiology. When you've got radiologists speaking out on this, you know there's something there. Matter of fact, recently, the American Board of Internal Medicine, one of the largest bodies of doctors in the country, put out a statement saying there is so much over-treatment and unnecessary medicine being practiced, that if you're going to have any one of these five specific tests or procedures in each specialty, and they made a list of five things in every specialty of internal medicine, think twice, get a second opinion, choose wisely. It's called their Choose Wisely campaign, came out a year ago. For the first time ever, we're having doctors speak up about this problem. Now, I'm a pancreas surgeon. It's a very highly specialized area of general surgery. I still do appendicitis and gallbladder surgery, and if you're really desperate, you want something done, I'm sure we can clear a table off here later on. Usually, if somebody's asking me about something outside of my area and I feel a little uncomfortable giving advice and they keep asking, I just recommend surgery, and then they stop asking for my opinion. In my field of pancreas surgery, there's an operation where we take out the pancreas, do some work on the organ, and then give the patient back the cells in the pancreas that make the insulin, the critical cells. It's called an autotransplantation. We take the pancreas out, work on it in a laboratory for a few hours, and give the organ back. Now, during those few hours, we also are sort of reconstructing the intestinal system. In order to take out the pancreas, you remove certain things and you have to sew them back together. And during the time that the laboratory team is working on the pancreas, me and my team are working on sewing back the bile duct to the intestine and the stomach to the intestine. That takes about an hour and a half. Usually when we're done rebuilding things and we're ready to put the cells back in, we put them into the liver, actually, where they live and grow. During that time, we reconstruct things, and then we have a little, usually half an hour or so where the patient remains asleep, the cells are almost ready. We take a little break. It's about an 8 or 10, sometimes 12-hour operation. And we take a little break, and then the cells are ready, and we infuse them. There's dramatic results, great results from this operation. Now, what I learned recently was that at some hospitals, when they take out the pancreas, they don't have the laboratory there in the operating room. They don't even have it at their institution. So what they do is they put it on ice and put it in a cooler, and like a regular transplanted organ, they package it, put it on an airplane, fly it to another city, and then have another laboratory in the other city work on it, and then they fly it back. By that time, the patient's long done with their surgery, and they bring the patient back for another surgery and cut them back open again and do the same and put the cells back in. Now, I was kind of shocked when I heard this was being done. Now, you might think this is some small little hospital where you would expect this level of sort of lack of full disclosure or different level of care, might I say. These are hospitals that rank in the top 10 in the United States in U.S. News World Report. I mean, some of these hospitals, if I told you the names, you'd be shocked. One of them is a Harvard hospital. One of them's a prominent California, one of the most famous hospitals in California. Matter of fact, they fly the organ from Los Angeles to Stanford to work on it and then fly it back. So I thought about this. Why would a hospital knowingly do this type of two-stage procedure? I mean, do you know how much jet fuel costs and a pilot and a plane and the cooler and the, let alone the plastic? I don't even know how much it totals, but it's got to be tremendously expensive, not to mention unfair to the patient. Why would a patient have this done? Well, they just don't know about the other option. The hospital is more concerned about losing that business than they are about what's best for the patient. Not only that, the doctors may be under pressure to build this program. I learned that the Medicare system sometimes pays a $20,000 bonus if you do this procedure per procedure because of the laboratory costs. Now, last time I explained this, somebody said, is that for go to the surgeon or does that go to the hospital? That goes to the hospital. I'm well aware of that. That's one thing that is clear. So we have these radically different ways of doing things in healthcare. Some of healthcare is evidence-based. In total, about 25%, according to the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association. 75% of what we do in healthcare is purely discretionary, and about 30% of it's unnecessary. Now, if we're going to get serious and talk about health costs in the United States, how can we not talk about the 30% of what we do that's unnecessary? Tremendous amount of waste, tremendous opportunities for risk reduction. Now, the Journal of the American Medical Association, one of our top two journals, just published a study a month ago that showed that when you publicly report the outcomes after a procedure like heart stent procedures, after the public reporting, compared to states that didn't have it and the before and after in states that started public reporting, the number of heart stents went down by 14%. No difference in patient outcomes. The patients did just as well. We can dramatically reduce healthcare costs in the United States with a little transparency or what I would call old-fashioned honesty with the public. We've got 200 national databases, and only 3 of them make their data available to the public. We as a society now have to face the question, do we believe that the public has a right to know about the quality of their hospitals? And I believe they do. Now, one individual who we got very good coverage on the book, and I was really blown away by it. The publisher told me, you know, it's unheard of to be a New York Times best-selling listed book without being reviewed in the New York Times. And this was just one of those books that I think connected with people in their everyday frustrations with healthcare. And The overall response has been very favorable, and I've gotten all this these letters and emails and people that say, you know, thank God we're finally being honest about the problem. But there's this old guard of medicine, and a couple of which have contacted me to say, there's no problem with medical mistakes, and why are you talking to the public about it? And that's the problem, is we have not been honest about what is now the number three cause of death in the United States. We talk a lot about number one, heart disease. We talk a lot about number two, cancer, number two cause of death. We spend a lot of money on that stuff. And we're just now debating if medical mistakes are even on the list. One of the reviewers said, I don't know if you have a copy. I'd love it if you see the hardback copy. Because I don't know if it's on the Kindle, but even if you just pick one up and look on the inside of the back cover, there's a typo. It's my degree. I have an MPH and an MD, and the MPH degree is listed as MPD. Now, I saw that and I thought, geez, you know, that's a typo. And the publisher quickly called me and apologized, and they said, we just did the first print run and we're so sorry. We had this little typo. They thought I was going to be angry. You know, I don't care about, you know, there's bigger, no one died. You know, there's bigger issues in this world. And I thought, no big deal. And now I've got 1,000 students at the medical school saying, I want to work on what you're working on. How do I get one of those MPD degrees? Is that what I need? Is that what I need to work on this? And I told them there is no such thing. It was just a typo. Well, one of the reviewers basically said that the book was flawed and pointed out that there was the typo on the inside cover. This is a prominent doctor in the United States. Now, we're trying to say that 30% of what we do in healthcare is unnecessary. And the response is, there's a typo. We're trying to say 30% of all medications, tests, and procedures don't need to be done and make healthcare way too costly and dangerous. And the response is, there's a typo. You know, health insurance premiums are not only going up, you're probably paying about 8% more than you did last year, and that year is about 9% more than the year before. Okay, these are not significant strides of progress that we're making in controlling healthcare inflation. Your deductibles are going up now to the point where your insurance is almost turning into catastrophic insurance. It's not really true insurance, it's more catastrophic insurance. So in other words, you're paying for this health care now. You're paying, when you go to the doctor's office, you're paying for more and more of that visit now. Soon you're going to be paying for all of it because your deductibles are going to go from 100 to 200 to 1,000 to 2,000. And then they're going to say, look, you can use your own health savings account, but you're responsible for the first $5,000 of health care expenditures. That's the only way they're going to be able to manage the unsustainable growth rate.
Marty McCary, a surgeon and the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Marty McCary in a moment, 840 94.9 KUOW. Landline phone use is plummeting. The telecom industry argues it should no longer be required to provide the service. Consumer groups disagree. A conversation about the future of the landline tonight at midnight. Lows near 40 tonight for the Seattle area. Breezy, showers likely. Friday highs somewhere in the 40s. Breezy, showers likely. Friday night, lows down into the 30s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers. Saturday highs, again around 40, cloudy skies, chance of showers. Seattle businesswoman Caroline Morrison traces her odyssey from Hollywood cigarette girl to Girl of the Galaxy at the 1962 World's Fair to successful Seattle entrepreneur, as recounted in her memoir, Twilight of the Blondes. Also, a visit with animal communicator Rachel Milliken as she carries out the task of finding out if, and if so, why Ulysses the dog is sulking. And a conversation with Dale Chihuly about his 47 years of groundbreaking glass artistry. All next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Marty McCary is a surgeon and the author of Unaccountable: What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15, 2012. Next, he discusses how to combat the problem of medical errors and waste.
So how can we talk about this problem that's driving the real growth of the national debt and burdening every family and making businesses lay off workers because they can't compete with businesses overseas without talking about the 30% of healthcare that's pure waste? You know, Dr. Rex is a doctor who's considered the most famous GI doctor in the country. And he, as one of the many doctors now that's rising up to speak openly and honestly about this problem, has talked about how colonoscopy is not done with the right level of care and the right standards. He's really the one who sort of pioneered the procedure. You know, when you turn 50, you're supposed to get a colonoscopy. Sorry to remind some of you. When you're supposed to get, not a fun topic to talk about. You know, we had a party once, and we had a sweepstakes, and we said, you know, one of the attendees of the Halloween party will get a free cancer screening colonoscopy. And it wasn't really an incentive to get people to come to the party, we found out. You know, I thought it was a nice thing. But he really is the man who pioneered the colon cancer screening, came up with the guidelines. He's the one who got the government to pay for it. He's really the hero of the GI field when it comes to cancer screening. Now, he's telling me there's way too much bad colonoscopy going on in the United States. His own hospital is considered to be the best hospital for colonoscopy and removal of large polyps, Indiana University. At his own hospital, these are video-based procedures like most things we do now in healthcare. And like most things we do in healthcare, the video is erased after the procedure. He decided to leave the video on, and at the end of the day, he would watch the colonoscopies, not know who the doctor was, and score them based on quality and based on time spent looking for the polyps. He came up with a 6-minute withdrawal standard. When you go all the way to the last part of the colon called the cecum, he should spend 6 minutes pulling the colonoscopy scope back and carefully looking for polyps and lesions, adenomas. After all, that's why you're doing the procedure. Well, he noticed people were pulling the scope back in 2 minutes. 4 minutes. It was all over the map. So he announced to his partners at this very good, some say the best hospital for this, I'm going to be watching your videos. And then he scored them again, blinded to the doctors. The time spent looking for polyps went up 40%. The quality scores went up by 35%. The power of accountability in healthcare can standardize care and significantly cut on the waste in healthcare. You know, we have been trying for decades as a society to get people to follow the speed limit. We've been trying for decades to get people to not run red lights. As long as there have been automobiles, we have been saying we need more education, this is a problem, and the compliance rates were still in the toilet. And then overnight, one innovation made almost everybody compliant with the law, and that's cameras. Now, I hate these things like you guys do. Okay, I drive back and forth in two cities, and there's one that sort of sneaks up on me every time I drive through it, and I get so many tickets on this one. A lot of times I know I'm going to get a ticket. I'm late to some emergency at the hospital. I just want to set up a direct deposit with my bank and the speed camera account because I'm paying so many. But I'm the only guy. Everyone else is following the law. There's something magical about accountability. There's something magical about no longer being anonymous. And when you're no longer anonymous, all of a sudden you behave better. And we have now started to talk about we should be saving what's taped. We've got most of modern medicine is video-based. Heart stents, arthroscopic knee surgery, laparoscopic hysterectomy, robotic surgery, all video-based procedures. Most radiology is video-based. Why are we destroying these images? We've got the capabilities. Can't we put that in the patient's record and give the patients a copy? You know, one of the doctors down the street from my hospital put in 500 unnecessary heart stents. It was all over the papers, the Wall Street Journal. He got fired. It was a big deal. These patients were suing. And if they would have had a copy of their procedure, they would have seen the vessel was not blocked when the stent was placed. That's how they eventually discovered it. But we may not have had 500 unnecessary, probably a lot more procedures. Now, I mentioned this in an article I wrote in the Wall Street Journal a few weeks ago. I thought it was a very positive article as I outlined the new movement in healthcare to make the field more transparent. But the Wall Street Journal, in their wisdom, assigned the title, "How to Stop Hospitals from Killing Us," which is not working well towards the goal of making sure that this is a doctor-led, healthcare-led effort. You know, we're all on the same page. When one of the astronauts was asked from outer space, "What does the Middle East look like?" He said, "You know, there are no lines looking from space. You realize the lines there are man-made, and there's a lot of commonality in mankind." And that's the same thing with healthcare. The lines in healthcare are man-made. If you talk to the executives at the insurance companies, the hospital administrators, the nurses in the emergency room, the head of the doctors' association, the patients, and many of them have been patients themselves, you realize the lines are man-made, and we all want ultimately safe and good health care without the waste that we have in there today. You know, I just want to end with this one account. One of my friends at a hospital has cameras in his operating rooms, and he started to run the videotapes, and he would use the videos to give it back to doctors to allow them to sort of learn from their operations. This was a program that Caprice Greenberg did and published recently in one of our journals. She's at University of Wisconsin, and there's been some talk of this idea of coaching. And, you know, just like football teams watch their plays, they're learning from their experiences. And he started turning the cameras on, and he was had this program going, but the surgeons started covering the cameras with the shoe boots that we put on. And soon, about half the operating rooms had these shoe covers on. You know, it's 2012. It's time for the shoe covers to come off. We can be honest about our mistakes. When President Garfield, who many say was the most popular president in U.S. history. You see, Garfield, he was about four after Lincoln. He didn't want to be president, unlike all the other presidents that want to be president since they're 6 years old. He didn't want to be president. They begged him to do it. He was considered one of these guys who didn't believe in the artificial man-made lines of society. He really saw the commonality. He criticized any language that would polarize the country and create these artificial competing camps. Instead, he always tried to seek the commonality of any issue. Everybody loved Garfield. Garfield had some very progressive ideas that African Americans and women should vote in the United States. And he was ahead of his time, yet his tenure as president was limited to just a few months. You see, after he got elected, Gateau shot him at the train station in Washington, D.C. And the bullet, now Garfield was a big guy, the bullet sat underneath his skin in what we call the subcutaneous fat, right underneath the dermis. He was, you know, it was in his back, and it came in on his right side. And they didn't know what to do. They took Garfield back to the White House, and over the next couple months, seven different doctors probed his wound with their bare hands without having washed their hands and put dirty instruments in there. Garfield eventually got an infection, which had spread to his left side. Now, the doctors were dead set on taking the bullet out. Matter of fact, it was really the idea of one doctor who had self-appointed himself the head doctor for Garfield, just because he was self-appointed when Lincoln got assassinated. He figured he was the guy for this, and he kind of pushed out all these Civil War doctors who knew that you don't have to chase these bullets out. You see, bullets are often sterile, and sometimes we leave them in. Sometimes I think a tenth of East Baltimore has bullets that we've left in some nights after a busy trauma call. But the bullets are sterile, and oftentimes, unless are actively in an area of disruption, we'll often leave them in until somebody's better and then, you know, decide whether or not it's worth offering an operation. The bullet was sterile and did no harm, but the infection killed him. And the autopsy later showed the bullet sitting there doing no harm. Now, I love it. Guiteau, and I'll end with this quote, Guiteau at the time of his trial said, as his defense, I just shot the president. The doctors are the ones who killed him. So I want to thank you for your time, and I love interaction. So if you want to chat or ask questions, please throw any questions my way, and thanks for listening.
So Tim O'Reilly writes about the Wanamaker problem in medicine. Wanamaker was the Philadelphia department store magnate who famously said that half the money I spend on advertising is wasted. I just don't know which half. Now, Google has sort of solved that problem, right? When Google collects a lot of data about us, it figures out what ads we're going to click on and then charges per click. And he suggests, well, maybe, you know, big data can do this the same thing for medicine, that we can collect so much data that we can predict what is wasted, the 30%, not the 50%. But what are your thoughts on the feasibility of this project? I think there's a bunch of problems with the idea.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for bringing it up. You know, doctors were right for a long time to resist and actually warn about transparency. They said, we can't have this data out there because it's misleading. It doesn't adjust for how risky some cases are, and some hospitals take on very high-risk cases. This has a special place in my heart at Johns Hopkins, where I practice. A lot of these patients are told there's nothing that can be done, and we give it a shot. We tell them the risks, taking on some of the most high-risk cases in the country. If we just put data out there that's not clean and appropriate, it's not doctor-endorsed, we can just punish those that take on the high-risk cases and reward those that discriminate against them. Now, for the first time, the American College of Surgeons, the cardiology group, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, the national databases and the coordinating centers run by doctors are saying we've got good ways to adjust for how risky cases are, and we think this is suitable for prime time. They're giving the data to Medicare, and we're starting to see some stuff, and it's not perfect, but we're starting to see the early signs of good user-friendly data, like Consumer Reports is a great resource. And in the book, we go through all the websites and resources. Some are helpful, some are not so helpful. But Consumer Reports is going to end up, I think, being a real standard. If you're going to have a baby, you should be able to look up a hospital's C-section rate and know whether or not it's 5%, as some are, or 40%, as some are, within Washington, D.C., my city. You should be able to know the infection rate, the readmission rate, adjusted for how complex the case. Just a few simple things, and this is all now being driven by the doctors' groups. So I think we're all learning this together. There's no silver bullet, which is, of course, what everybody wants. Nobody wants to appreciate the complexity of the data. So I hope that in part answered your question.
Do you want to go?
Sure. Okay. This year I had a procedure that was mentioned tonight at a hospital just up the road, and I was laying on in the operating room, laying on my side, and they brought me something to sign. And I couldn't even, it was so dark I couldn't read. They didn't tell me what it was. Just sign this. I couldn't believe it. It was almost laughable.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I'd like to say that it's a rare instance that you're describing. Unfortunately, not only is that common, I admit I was a part of that system as a resident. The head surgeon wants you to sign that form with the patient quickly and for you to get back to your duties. And you're in there. You don't even know what this operation is sometimes when you're one of these interns getting the consent. And now there's this movement saying, hey, look, we need shared decision making. You need to be told all of your risks independent of the doctor. All kinds of studies have shown that we as doctors understate risks and overstate benefits before procedures. And now the shared decision making movement is saying, how about an independent discussion of the risks by with a video or a pamphlet by somebody else before you're going to have something done? And they say, you know, if people really knew all the risks, probably about 5% fewer people would choose to have the operation. And there's also a lot of cost savings there as well as the preventable harm. Please.
Great talk. There's an important player you didn't mention, and that is the reason there is 30% of what doctors do is unnecessary. The reason the shoe booties are put in place, the reason the videos are discarded, and the reason there is so little transparency is because of fear of lawsuits. What can we do about that?
It's a great question. And there's probably no, you sound like you're a physician because, you know, honestly, it's
yeah,
almost.
Well, I'm a radiologist. Doug is a radiologist. And probably 40 to 50% of what we do is clearly unnecessary, but we don't control it,
yeah.
Right?
I really appreciate that perspective. You know, there's probably nothing that unites us as doctors on a more visceral level than the problem of malpractice in the United States. And I think a lot of us are honest to say it's not the cure of our healthcare system. We're not going to completely fix all the problems in healthcare by fixing malpractice, but we need some common sense malpractice reform. Now, I got to be honest with you. In Washington, D.C., I see what our doctors' groups are up against. The lobby of the trial lawyers is so powerful that they're embedded throughout the government. Do you know that the Secretary of Health and Human Services is a former trial lawyer and a former leader of the Trial Lawyers Association in her region? I mean, we don't realize that a lot of times lawyers not only are writing the law, but they're sort of barricading themselves from the common sense reforms that 99% of doctors universally believe that we need. And there's no issue in the country, probably, beyond what color should be on the American flag, where there's 99% consensus, and that's one of them.
Marty McCary, a surgeon and the author of Unaccountable, What Hospitals Won't Tell You and How Transparency Can Revolutionize Healthcare. He spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on November 15th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from UW Robinson Center for Young Scholars.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.